too.
Thanks very much. So as I say, Rainbow Thief, Yoda Rimowski's last movie. There have been more novels and comic strips and even some new work for the theatre, but there have been no more movies, despite Yoda Rimowski's best efforts. Alan Klein, John Lennon's old manager, continues to block Yoda Rimowski's plans to make a sequel to El Topo. And other prospects that Yoda Rimowski have had in view, for example, a gangster movie that would be shot in Chile entirely at night, which was inspired by his son's beard, and another in which a 60-year-old philosopher, not a million miles from Yoda Rimowski himself, is seduced in order to sire the second coming of Christ, had come to nothing. But despite the fact that I have been, this thing that I've been firmly planting in your mind, the idea that the importance of Yoda Rimowski to cinema history is his status as a mystic who momentarily made sense in terms of what was happening in cinema in the early 70s. I don't want to leave you with the impression that it's as simple as that. That Yoda Rimowski has failed so many times as a filmmaker simply because cinema is so a spiritual medium. It is more complicated. I had the opportunity to meet with Yoda Rimowski in 1993. I went over to Paris where I interviewed him for several days. The first time I met him, he was indeed ensconced in the basement of the Brasserie Je Suis, giving one of his regular Wednesday afternoon tarot readings. At these sessions, you weren't required to pay him. What you did was you traced the word merci across the palm of his hand. That was the only payment he required. The room was absolutely packed with people. It was a big space. People that were in awe of Yoda Rimowski. And Yoda Rimowski is held in great regard in Paris for his ability to read the tarot. That afternoon, one of Yoda Rimowski's subjects turned over the card, The Hanged Man. The illustration showed a figure wearing a tunic adorned with four bright buttons. Yoda Rimowski pointed to the buttons on the cardigan of the girl sitting in front of him, who's reading this was, and began to tell her a story about her. That evening, Yoda Rimowski went on to give one of his regular midweek lectures on the tarot at the Sorbonne University. These are very regular events. Pamphlets of the lectures are always on sale outside. These are pamphlets produced by Yoda Rimowski's unofficial disciples. Got a couple here of his cabaret exotiques. One is just typed out on a word processor. The other, in fact, is written entirely by hand by one of his more committed followers. They should be committed. That's a representative paper, one of these, details how the staff at Euro Disney were going to become serial killers because they spent their working days living inside the skins of other animals. Mickey Mouse, Donald Duck, Goofy, Winnie the Pooh, Tigger. Certainly, Yoda Rimowski is the mystical man that I've been giving you the impression of so far. His business card that he'll present to you describes him as lucid dreamer. And later in that week that I spent with him, a party of other Parisian tarot readers visited him for advice and consultation. But as large a part of Yoda Rimowski's character as the mystical side is his status as an absurdist, an iconoclast who, far from believing in secret, arcane, occult systems of meaning, takes great joy in dismantling every single meaning system with which he's presented. He's an impossible and hugely entertaining interviewee because he simply makes things up as he goes along. A book of his which had recently been published when we met was a family history which finished with his birth. Except this was a fiction, a novel. And questions I asked him about his past and his career were answered with anecdotes which may have been just as made up. A typical moment came on the last night I was with him when his cat jumped up on the table. Ah, I said, I read in an interview that you've always kept cats. Yes, it's true, he said. And it's always a male cat. Yes, it's true. and you always have them neutered. Yes, it's true, otherwise they piss everywhere. And you keep all the testicles in a canoptic jar by the side of your bed. Yes, it's true. And on top of all those testicles is your own foreskin from when you were circumcised in Chile as a baby. Bit of a pause. Okay, I lie, it's all made up, you say. I mentioned already that Santa Sangre is based on the Mexican serial killer Gojo Cardenas. Apparently Cardenas, according to Jodorowsky, murdered 30 women, was incarcerated in a mental institution, and then re-emerged in later life as a lawyer and TV pundit in Mexico City. Jodorowsky claims to have met him in the Mexican capital one night in a bar, just bumped into this guy. You get talking as you do, you know, I killed 30 women. when Jodorowsky told this story in the many interviews in the wake of Santa Sangre's release, it was strange how the story kept sort of changing from interview to interview. And actually, I've not been able to find any record of Gojo Cardenas whatsoever, and I suspect he's entirely a figment of Jodorowsky's imagination. When Jodorowsky arrived in New York in 1970, he was embraced by the counterculture as one of us. But Jodorowsky himself claims that despite the drug rights that you find in El Topo and the Holy Mountain, prior to his arrival in the United States, he'd never even smoked a joint of marijuana. He said the first time he saw one was when he went to the New York Museum of Modern Art. At the end of the session, I'm going to hand out a personal biography that he wrote in post-production to the Holy Mountain. It's kind of a blank verse biography. And in that biography, he characterizes himself as an eternal outsider. It works through the different places that he's lived and how he's always treated as coming from somewhere else. So in Chile, he's treated as a Jew. In Mexico, he's treated as coming from Chile. In America, he's treated as a Mexican. In France, the story goes on. And it finishes with him going to another planet. And on this other planet, they treat him as an outsider because they think he's American. For him, which this is the ultimate insult. You ask Jodorowsky what nationality he is, and he will say that he's Jodorowsky. His relationship to all the cultures that have embraced him, to the cultures indeed that at various points in his career he's actually had a big hand in creating, has always been antagonistic. And to get a clearer, he's always been on the outside, if you like. And to get a clearer sense of the iconoclastic anarchist that is the other half of Jodorowsky's character, well, we need to go back to that portion of his life that predates his explosion in New York in 1970 onto the East Coast hippie scene. In Chile at Santiago University, he was expelled for attacking Catholics in a billboard-style newspaper that he put up on the wall. He says that when they ripped it down, they just put it up on another wall the next day. That's the advantage of this method of publication. So he left Santiago University, where he was studying psychology and philosophy, and he became instead a circus clown. And then he became an actor-director for Chile's theatre. By 1953, he had a company of 50 players beneath him. And his response to his success was to hop on a freighter, spur-of-the-moment thing, and end up in France. In France, he studied mime and actually wrote the most famous of Marcel Marceau's white-faced routines. So all those jokes about the terrible street performers doing the cage or the mass breaker, you know, traps inside the box and then he traps inside the cage. Well, that is Jodorowsky's work. It's another thing that he can take credit for. Marcel Marceau and the mime troupe that Jodorowsky formed with him, again, enjoyed great success. But in 1960, during the world tour with Marceau, Jodorowsky decided simply to get off the bus at Mexico City. And he stayed there for 10 years. The politically febrile, agitatory, oppositional atmosphere of Mexico culturally really suited Jodorowsky. And it led him to invent, together with the playwrights Fernando Arrabal and Roland Topor, a theatrical movement called the Panic Movement. Panic specialised in unrepeatable, once-only performances or happenings, which used as their weapons scandal and shock in order to challenge the bourgeois restrictions of theatre. The first panic happening, Sacramental Melodrama, tells us most of what we need to know. Staged in 1965 in Paris, and it saw Jodorowsky dressed in leather, backed by a rock band, stripped, whipped, covered in honey, covered in snakes. It lasted 4 hours, during which time Jodorowsky decapitated chickens, fed an effigy of the Pope with apricots, attacked a rabbi on stage, and pelted the audience with little baby turtles. The show was overburdened, almost, with symbolism. And the point, in one sense, was that it meant nothing, that those symbols couldn't possibly add up to any meaning, that life is too crazy, too complex, too beautiful, too horrible to explain. You arrive at a meaning if you like, but the meaning is the least interesting thing about this incredible, exorbitant performance that happened occurring in front of you. So to quote Jodorowsky, the mystic again, for him, the universe is the laugh of God, and it's this crazy, incoherent laugh that Jodorowsky is aiming to conjure up in those happenings. The same sense that Jodorowsky had of the constrictions of theatre that led to the panic movement caused him eventually to retreat from theatre altogether. He drove him first to write a comic strip for a right-wing Mexican newspaper. Of the experience, he said, when they realised what I was saying, it was too late to do anything about it because a million people were reading it. And it caused him also, finally, to turn to cinema. He made one film, one little sort of piece of film theatre, really, in Paris in the 1950s. But his first feature film, Fando Elise, which he made over 2 years, about 1966-1968, is based on a play by one-time collaborator Fernando Arrabal. But the film as a whole feels more like a disavowal of the theatre, a disavowal of that play. It uses flashbacks, it uses primitive camera effects, it pays homage to Fellini and to Buñuel. It harnesses the reality effect of cinema to surreal ends. By that I mean cinema's ability to capture real people, flesh and blood people, doing real things to each other in real places. And the use of all of these devices pointed to Jodorowsky turning his back on another by now limiting phase in his life. In making this film, Jodorowsky refused to use a script. He said that over the course of those 2 years, he and his cast simply remembered what the play was about. But while Jodorowsky, in Fando Elise, retained the play's two central characters, a boy and girl couple, the girl being pushed by the boy in a pram, she's crippled, looking for the legendary land of Tar, which will make everything right again. Jodorowsky relegated the other three characters of the play, three men bearing umbrellas, to a single scene set in the theatre itself. And I want to show you that scene, and also some of the more cinematic moments that surround that scene. Jodorowsky, as usual, is in this film. He is the puppet master that you see at the start, freeing his marionettes from the stage.
Thank you. Andrew si nascose sotto la foglia, la casa dietro la porta e la città nella casa. Io guardavo e vedevo cambiarsi tutto. L'albero che diventava foglia, la casa che diventava porta e la città che diventava casa. Però io non riesco a nascondermi fra le mie mani.
General he's about to kill, I am God. And then he proves it by cursing this general with old age. He shoots up his toupee, making him bald. He then castrates him with a knife, making him impotent. But soon, Jodorowsky's mystical proclamations in this film begin to sort of sound like so much gobbledygook. And we begin to doubt the truth of what we hear. And I have a typical case in point lined up for you now.
The line I really wanted to include there is
The desert is circular, so to find the masters we must travel in a spiral. So short about that as a method of orienteering myself. As El Topo continues, we arrive at the second half in which Topo is asked to dig a tunnel to release the freaks from their cave. But something that El Topo agrees to do. But he makes it down to the tower, which the freaks want to reach via this tunnel, without the aid of a tunnel. And when the tunnel is dug, it proves doubly pointless by leading directly to the murder of all the cave's inhabitants. El Topo revenges the death of the cave dwellers and then kills himself. And we leave the movie very much as it began, with a town full of dead people and a burial. This time, the burial of El Topo, rather than the toys of his son that we see at the start of the picture. El Topo may be an epic and mystical journey, but it's a journey, it seems, into nowhere. This is, in fact, a pretty consistent pattern in Jodorowsky's best films. In Santa Sangre, we learn that most of what we have seen in the last 2 hours has simply been a lie inside the hero's head. While in The Holy Mountain, Jodorowsky is seen to turn his back on the film and stomp off before the movie itself is even over. The Holy Mountain was a truly suicidal act for Jodorowsky to make as a filmmaker. El Topo, despite the fact that it actually seems to disavow much of the simple-minded mysticism embraced by the Love Generation, had been lauded by America's later hippies as a deeply meaningful experience, as appealing to all of those simple-minded notions. So, what does Jodorowsky do next but go make a movie which takes to task the whole notion of him as a guru to the 1970s counterculture? The end of The Holy Mountain may have come about as a result of Jodorowsky losing heart with his cast during production, but the movie as a whole seems to be a declaration of war on the commodification of hippie culture that Jodorowsky found in America. Early on in the movie, we stumble on a factory that's mass-producing Christs modelled on the hippie-esque thief character that at one point was going to be played by John Lennon. Later, when we meet the various super criminals who are going to storm the Magic Mountain, we find among them Klein, not so dissimilar a name from Klein, Alan Klein, an art dealer who owns a factory which produces art, which reminds us rather of Andy Warhol's New York factory. We also meet Eisler, the armourer, who quartermasters the teenage rebellion by providing, and I quote from the film, arms for its marches and sit-ins, and drugs which produce delusions of grandeur. We also meet a character named Axon, another guru, who has a penchant for collecting testicles. Story from a while back. It seems that even as his moment arrived as a filmmaker, Jodorowsky is so determined to alienate the audience that has embraced it, that film itself, like theatre, will, with The Holy Mountain, become for Jodorowsky a thing of the past. He's writing himself out as a filmmaker with The Holy Mountain. Jodorowsky, I think you'll agree from what I've said so far, is in no way a careerist filmmaker. Santa Sangre took so long to make because it actually started out as a movie that could never be made. In the late 1970s, Louis Buñuel's former producer, Gustavo Alatriste, decided to approach Jodorowsky and ask him to write and direct 12 movies over the course of 1 year. And these would be released in Mexico only on a very well-defined exploitation circuit. They were going to be made dirt cheap. And Alatriste promised Jodorowsky $5,000 if he could deliver the first script within 3 days of their initial meeting. Alatriste told Jodorowsky, "Don't think about quality, don't think about nothing. We'll make a story about criminals." So Jodorowsky's response, and again, quoted from my interview with him, was to write the most surrealistic script I ever wrote in my life. An opera in which everything is singing. The serial killer is singing. He kills a pregnant woman who is singing as she is murdered. He slices open her belly and inside the fetus. It is singing. Gustavo Alatriste's response was, "Keep the money, you are impossible. Don't come to see me again in your life." 10 years later, with a few rewrites, Santa Sangre is eventually made. And in truth, many other of Jodorowsky's still unmade projects were conceived in exactly the same way. Many of those that I was outlining in Jodorowsky was considering in the wake of El Topo were never seriously intended. When Jodorowsky is asked about his filmmaking technique, he says that when he does make a film, he always makes five. There's at least five movies in any one movie that he made. When he was asked in the late 1970s why he hadn't made a film for so long, his response was that he simply used up all his images on the Holy Mountain. A normal filmmaker would eke out his images. He would reserve ideas for his next picture so that there is work to come. But not Jodorowsky. To put it another way, it's Jodorowsky's absurdist, iconoclastic, self-destructive streak. His willingness to treat the project in hand as the last movie, maybe, that he'll ever make, that drives his extraordinary pictures, as much as his willingness to translate mystical notions into striking film images. For me, Jodorowsky's greatest work, and it is one of my favourite films, I don't know how much of a guilty admission that is The Holy Mountain. Like all Jodorowsky's best films, it's shot in Mexico. It's a film that reeks of the rage and the clamour of the streets of Mexico City. And this is a rage which is compounded by Jodorowsky's attack, in this case, on the hippie audience that so recently embraced it. And it's a rage which also expresses the customary war one finds in Jodorowsky's films, between his mystical and his absurdist urges. The film expresses his fury against all organized systems of belief. And the resulting movie does beg a belief. You do not believe your eyes while watching The Holy Mountain. If Jodorowsky occasionally thought that The Holy Mountain was the last film that he'd ever make, then for me, sometimes, The Holy Mountain feels like the last film I ever need to see. And I want to show you the opening sequence after the opening sequence I'll discuss. Thank you. That's about it. Now, I got the biography of the Jodorowsky written about himself. In terms of a reference, there is a very good Jodorowsky website called Alejandro Jodorowsky, The Symbol Rose. And for any of you who do have internet access, the address is all lowercase hotweird.com/Jodorowsky, which is JODOROWSKY. If anyone has any questions, I probably would be able to answer them anyway.
I felt you say completely self-indulgent. Does he actually believe that there actually is an audience for him?
No, he says that, well, the reason why he agreed to meet me was that I sent him his proposal, which he read, and he said, "Oh, I think you understand that I don't make films for other people. Because my cinema is my masterpiece, which is my soul." He makes them entirely for himself. That's one reason why he's in so many of his pictures, why he uses his family in so many of his pictures. He's got four sons and a daughter. His daughter refuses to be in his movies. All four sons of his have been in his films, as has his former wife, Valerie Jodorowsky. He also wanted to make a film which features his father, who has sadly died fairly recently. One of his sons, Brontis, who plays a little boy in El Topo, had lived apart from Jodorowsky for 7 years in Paris with his mother. And they came together on the set of El Topo. Brontis was 7 years old at the time, so this was virtually their first meeting. And the first thing you see in El Topo is Jodorowsky reenacting the rejection of his son. He's working out some very personal things here. So, no, he wages war on his audience as he does very... savagely, I think, in the Holy Mountain.
I'll ask the last question. Very grandiose. How did we get such funding? That would be a high knowledge to the audience.
Well, I think, as I was saying in the first part of the talk, there was just a moment when he seemed to make sense. Where because of the disarray in which American cinema found itself, the forces of the counterculture, the new demands of the youth audience, the vogue, mysticism, spirituality, use of hallucinogenics, etc., that were in place at the end of the 60s, Jodorowsky just seemed to make sense for a moment, and hence the money. But the money was quickly withdrawn, basically because with The Holy Mountain, Jodorowsky didn't make a film for that audience. You know, as Alan Bogle said, he didn't pull it back for the kids. In fact, he gave the kids one in the breadbasket, really, and then disappeared to Paris. And he's always had trouble getting any money since. I would say he by no means lives in penury in Paris. He has a nice house in Vincennes. He drives a BMW, which is the one thing that I didn't expect. This guy had just been talking about serial killers inside Dumbo costumes. He says, "Oh, you want a lift? I'm not getting in a car with you." But he has patrons because he is held in such high regard in terms of his. Tarot, and he does make money from the comic strips he writes. His novels are published in many countries in Europe, but they're not translated into English. He is still held in high regard, but not as a filmmaker. In terms of the tarot work, incidentally, what I was sort of implying earlier was that, yes, he does see the cards as this sort of mystic resource, but primarily what he is an artist. He may be a mystical artist, but what he does is he has the cards there and he tells a story from those elements in just the same way that he uses elements of his life to tell the story that he's telling you at this moment about his life. It may not be true, but it's a great performance. And this, if you're told a story about yourself by Jodorowsky, that's a kind of, it's very sort of privileging. And you've seen it in a little performance of Jodorowsky's himself. So that's the way in which he uses the tarot.
Well, When you suggested to him that he may have been influenced by Philly Nibbleware, does he celebrate that or refuse it?
No, he's very candid about all of the homages. In fact, he says for El Topo, it was a film of borrowings. It was a film that represented his entire library, and also that sort of psychic library of films that he'd stored up. So there are references to Piero Lefou in there as well. In The Holy Mountain, again fairly early on, after this effigy has been made of this thief character into a Christ that's being sold by this Christ factory, the thief takes one of his effigies, ties balloons to it, and floats it above Mexico City, which is obviously a very direct Fellini homage. He's absolutely candid about those borrowings. In Santa Sangre, he has the central character mimicking the actions of Claude Rains as the Invisible Man as he watches it on TV. He makes no bones about his indebtedness to anyone.
I think Wilson is like that, films made in the manner of Jurassic.
I'd like to think he'll make another good movie. He may well make another movie, but it may judder into existence rather. He says, film every 7 years is okay for me, the rest of the time I live in my life. He's not yet 70 and he's very chipper. So he may make another movie. When El Topo was shown on television, last year now, I think it was. It had a little introduction from Christopher Fraley, who rather unkindly said, in terms of influence, Jodorowsky has had none. He just lives in sort of cyberspace. It's just this kind of byway. To a degree, that's true, but in an odd way, he's had a lot of influence. Rather a damaging influence on Dennis Hopper. Almost ruined his film career with the last movie, but he made tenable that whole midnight movie slot. So it's down to Jodorowsky that those films and filmmakers that I mentioned earlier took hold. Filmmakers like David Lynch, like George Romero, like Toby Hooper, they owe a great debt. You watch Mad Max after watching The Double Man in that movie, and you see where in Mad Max 2 many of those ideas come. In terms of there being room for Jodorowsky's sort of mystical, irrational approach to film, then no, we won't see his like again. Unless there's some great world disaster which puts spirituality into a different area of our lives, and maybe there'll be space for Jodorowsky's worldview, but otherwise, maybe. You know, 21st century. Sons of El Topo 2001 may be on its way. But yeah, basically, the Black Plague or a meteorite hitting Earth. That's what we need the Jodorowsky's filmmaking approach to come back into fashion.
On that note, Ed, back to the words.
Well, just
film. It's an excellent French one, another in our Truffaut season, La Peau Douce.
...and may require parental guidance.